Blog Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about something new. A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour, live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
G's Power Hour.
Yeah.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. Really glad that you could spend some time with us during your lunchtime or whatever it is that you're doing. Anyway, a couple of things going on. We're going to talk a little bit about one of the things that is being honored this month, that is Sickle Cell Disease Awareness Month. We're going to talk a little bit about that, and then we're going to be back later in the hour with our Professor Gal Sarid from the Florida Research Institute, dealing with some of the issues going on in space. But right now, we have Beverly Frances Gibson, who is with the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and also with the Sickle Cell Disease Association. Hi, how are you? Good morning. We might be having a connection issue. I'm going to try to get her on quickly. But in the meantime, like I said, it is Sickle Cell Disease Awareness Month. And let me see if I can try to track her down. But if you have anybody in your family or you know of anybody, friend or relative, whatever, that is dealing with sickle cell, it is kind of a complicated condition, and we take every September to try to recognize Sickle Cell Disease Awareness Month. Ms. Frances Gibson, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Hi, good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. I am well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time out. So,
thank you for having me.
Thanks. And I know you're busy because this is a crazy month for you, but can you talk a little bit about, we want to kind of enlighten everybody because we don't really talk about it that much, you know, and unless you know somebody with it, it doesn't get that much of attention, but we want to really kind of enlighten, we want to take this time to kind of enlighten people about the disease and, you know, how to diagnose it, treatments for it, any type of activities that you all are doing this month. So could you just take it and get us started?
Yeah, definitely. So National Sickle Cell Awareness Month, which is the month of September, was designated by Congress to help us focus attention on the need for research and treatment of sickle cell disease. What I'd like your audience to know is that sickle cell disease is a genetic blood disorder. It is not contagious and is not something that you get from just touching or being in relationship with other people. It's through birth. And so if your parents, the mom and dad, have the sickle cell trait, then there's a 25% chance that your child will have the sickle cell disease. The disease is literally your red blood cell not being in a circle, and it's in the form of a sickle, which is why we call it sickle cell disease. And that sickled cell blocks oxygen from traveling throughout the body. That causes extreme pain and organ damage and lots of complications for sickle cell patients around the United States.
Now, I guess I want to find out is, how do you know or first become aware of the disease? Do you, is that something that people are tested for as, you know, in childhood?
Yes.
How does that happen?
Yes. So in the United States, There is newborn screening that's done for every single infant. And when a baby is born, the parents are then told by, and it's literally a pinprick, and they can determine whether or not that infant has sickle cell disease. I will tell you that there are over 2.5 million Americans, mostly African American, that carry the sickle cell trait, and we're estimating 100,000 individuals living with sickle cell disease in the U.S.
Now, have they always tested at infancy for sickle cell, or is that recent? And the reason I ask that is because I had a friend a long time ago that found out he was going into the service and wanted to, you know, I guess to fly, and found out mm-hmm. that he couldn't because he found out that he had, I'm assuming, the trait, or it may have been the full-blown disease. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, what happened was several years ago, there was federal legislation that mandated that all infants be tested for the disease. And then once that legislation expired, there was nothing for a little while. But that has been reinstituted, and so the testing is now mandatory across the United States for all infants. If someone is an adult and they don't know their status or they've never been tested, they can actually find out if they are, if they have the sickle cell trait or sickle cell disease by requesting a test with their doctor. And they would need to find out whether or not insurance would pay for it. Sometimes they don't. But it's a simple, like I said, a simple blood lab work that's done, and an adult can find out in a few months if they have the disease, an infant in a few weeks. And then there are resources across the country, ours being Sickle Cell Disease Association of America being the national organization, and then we have 46 member organizations across the country that are community-based that help to provide resources, treatment, and information to individuals living with the disease or their families.
So now, if you are an adult that did not get tested, what are some of the things that would make you suspect that this is something that you need to do at this point?
Extreme pain. So one of the major issues associated with sickle cell disease is extreme pain. And I say extreme pain because sickle cell patients experience what we call the pain crisis, and they may be hospitalized up to 13, 14, 15 times a year. We also have patients that have to stay hydrated. You may have patients that are being told that they have sickle cell trait, and then later they're finding out that there are complications associated with the trait that was actually masked all along. We have a lot of people who complain of arthritis and rheumatism, and sometimes inflammation is another, and then they find out it's actually sickle cell that's a part of it.
Wow.
So since it's blocking oxygen, it is affecting the joints throughout the body. And like I said earlier, we also have a number of patients who have lost organs. So there's organ damage that happens as a result of this disease. I have young people who have had to have retina replacement in their eyes because it also affects the eyes. We've had young people who've had to have hip replacement because it affects the hips and different parts of the body.
Wow. Now, you mentioned, because this is another thing that I wanted to clear up, too. It's always been, I shouldn't say always, but from what I understand, been assumed for the most part that it is an African-American disease. And while it is predominant in African-American communities, like you said, other people do get it as well, correct?
Yes. Yes. So we know for a fact that people who are from the Mediterranean, Middle Eastern, and Indian ancestry also have sickle cell disease. in addition to African Americans and people from Africa, sub-Sahara Africa. And so one of the things that I always try to share when I'm talking to different audiences is that just because you may not be African American doesn't mean that you may not, you don't have the disease or the trait. And so that's why we encourage people to get tested so that they know what their status is. And even more so before you start having children. So you know what the probability is that you may have a child with sickle cell disease, especially if the person that you're dating or the person that you're going to have a child with also has the sickle cell trait. I will tell you that we estimate globally that there are close to 300,000 babies born annually with sickle cell disease. And so it is extreme. And right now in the U.S., we only have 2 drugs on the market for sickle cell disease. There are about 45 drugs in the pipeline right now that are being clinically tried out to see if they will work and if they will be approved by the FDA. But we only have 2 drugs in 2019 for sickle cell disease, which is part of the reason why we're trying to raise awareness about this.
I was going to say, that's just crazy to me. As long as we've known about this disease, and I know I've known about it, you know, and don't have it, or I don't think I'll have it, I'll just put it that way, because I've never been tested for it. But as long as I have known about it, which has been since I was a child, and I'm not going to talk about how old I am or whatever, but what I'm going to say is, if you would have thought by now, there would have been more in the way of treatment for this disease.
No, I would tell you that that has not been the case, unfortunately. And even in my own family where I have a family member with sickle cell disease, and I just found out in April, and I've been doing this work for over a year and a half.
Oh, wow.
Because we don't talk about it.
We don't talk about it in our families.
We're not discussing it. You know, we're told to, you know, don't share your business. And we have people, unfortunately, young people that are dying from sickle cell disease because of stigma and because of how they're treated. And so people, what I say is that people are dying silently from this disease, and it could have been prevented.
Oh, man. That's not good at all. That's not good at all. That's why we do have to talk about it. And we got to talk about it more than just once a year also, too. That's the thing.
Yes.
And like you were saying, and I have to give my mom kudos for this. You know, a lot of times it was like, you know, old folks didn't want to talk about stuff, you know.
And exactly. My
mom was one of those people. She's like, okay, you need to know this, you know.
Yes.
You know, even if it was her, you know, she wasn't doing sickle, it wasn't sickle cell for her. It was like high blood pressure and heart disease.
Yes,
this is what
exactly.
I'm taking. This is how much I'm taking. And this is, you know, and all of that, you know. So I was like coming up, was like, you know, it wasn't news to me. I always knew, you know, she was taking this medication, she was taking this dosage, so if anything ever happened to her, or I needed to know what my issues might be coming down the road. And that's very important that we talk about that.
Yes, and that's one of the things that I love to hear, that your mom did that, and that's what we're trying to also encourage our generations to do, is to share with their children, their grandchildren, what are some of the diseases or the issues, health concerns that generationally have existed within families. Because I will tell you, there are a lot of people who said to me, oh, I thought sickle cell disease was gone. I thought it had been eradicated because we weren't talking about it. No one was hearing anything about it. And I'm like, no, that's not the case. We went silent. And when there was no funding for it, obviously, then there was no attention focused on it. And I will share with you, we had a small victory last year because the Sickle Cell Treatment Act was passed by the current president into law, but there was no funding connected to that. So if you have legislation but no money, then nothing happens.
Right.
And so a lot of what we are trying to do at the national level is to advocate for change, advocate for funding, for research, so that sickle cell patients and individuals who are their caregivers know that there is hope and that there are people fighting on their behalf every day. So although it's Sickle Cell Awareness Month, we work around the clock all year long to raise awareness about sickle cell disease and sickle cell trait.
And as we were just talking about, if you're just joining us, it is Sickle Cell Disease Awareness Month, and we are here with Beverly Frances Gibson of Sickle Cell Disease Association and
of America.
Take a quick break. Of America, thank you. This is G's Power Hour. I've never had it so good entertainment. If you have questions, the number is 516-387-1944. That is 516-387-1944, and we will be right back.
Over the past 60 years, Dove Beauty Bar's superior formula has remained unchanged. But when it comes to beauty, everything changed. Together, we redefined beauty. We said no to stereotypes and yes to every type. We let go of judgments and embraced what makes us unique. We're proud to have been there with you, caring for you every step of the way. Here's to the next 60 years.
This is Douglas Dobbs of Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service. We have served the Central Florida community for 29 years with quality funeral and cremation services. Honoring all religions and faiths, we have been here for many grieving families. Whether it's a complete funeral service with a burial or a simple, dignified cremation, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service is here for you. Located at 430 North Kirkman Road at the 408 Expressway, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service, 407-578-7720. Dobbs. Dedicated to serving our families.
Good morning and welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. It is National Sickle Cell Awareness, Sickle Cell Disease Awareness Month, and we are here with Beverly Frances Gibson, who is the president and CEO of Sickle Cell Disease Association of America. And I wanted to ask you, because I have known in the past, like I said, not recently, I guess because a lot of people aren't talking about it, but I have known a couple of cases where I've had, let's say, a classmate or a coworker, and it's like, well, you know, where are they? You know, you come in, you know, where are they? And they've ended up in crisis. So I wanted to ask you, you know how we used to have those, and I guess we still have medical bracelets or whatever.
Yes.
Is that something, like you said, you have a family member you weren't aware that they were suffering with the disease. Are there things that sickle cell patients can do to make other people aware that this is what they're dealing with and that there may be a time when they need help? And then if you're the person that doesn't have it but you know of someone, is there a way to help them, especially if they go into crisis?
Yeah, I will tell you that a lot of our sickle cell patients have their own networks, and a lot of them rely on caregivers, family members and friends, and other people to help them. The issue with sickle cell is that you could wake up at 8 a.m. and be fine, and by 8:30, 9 o'clock, you could have a pain crisis. And each patient, it manifests differently. And so there's no cookie-cutter way for us to, because we've been trying to figure out how can we help patients, you know, get the help that they need. And a lot of it is what we're talking about. It's raising awareness. It's informing and educating, actually, emergency room doctors and nurses, because many of them don't know what to do when a sickle cell patient shows up at the ER. And I will tell you that many sickle cell patients rely on opioids because that is what helps them to control the pain. However, because of the opioid crisis in our country, sickle cell patients are being mislabeled as drug seeking. And so as a result, they show up at the emergency room having a pain crisis, and they're left to sit in the ER for hours, which makes it even worse. And by the time their physician is, you know, contacted to confirm this is a sickle cell patient, sometimes it's too late. And so we are also trying to educate emergency room physicians and nurses about sickle cell disease and why when someone shows up at the ER, they need to treat them because the patients know what they need. The patients know what the dose, the right dosage is for mitigating the pain. And sometimes they are totally ignored. They're sent back home. They're left to sit in emergency rooms for crazy hours. And then the pain crisis becomes something else. And like I said, between 2018 and 2019, I'm aware personally of over 15 to 20 people in their 20s and 30s who've died from sickle cell disease because of how they're treated. Many of the patients refuse to go to the ER, or they wait until the last possible moment, and by then it's too late.
That's just awful to hear. That really is.
Yes. Yes.
Because
I will tell you, we had a seven-year-old child that had a stroke, because sickle cell patients, young children, end up having strokes with sickle cell disease that more than any other disease. And that seven-year-old child was then out of school for weeks because she had had a stroke. But people can't even believe that. I was like, how can a seven-year-old have a stroke? Well, sickle cell disease does that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to also work with school systems because, you know, no one in her school, her teacher, no one recognized that she was going into a crisis at the time. And by the time it was recognized, she had a full-blown stroke at age seven. And so we are trying to really raise the bar to make sure that people, regardless of who you are, where you work, you know someone with sickle cell disease. 100,000 people living in the United States with sickle cell disease, that's a lot of folks. And even if you're not sure, you know, the main thing we try to say to people is to let them know that you're there to support them. They don't need to be judged. They don't need to be treated any kind of way. What they're looking for is support, and they need to know that people trust that when they say they're in a pain crisis, they're having a full-blown crisis.
I just wish we had more time, and I wish that we had more knowledge. Where can we get information? Because I have to tell you, and I'm not trying to disparage anybody, but I have had a hard time finding information in terms of what's going on here locally in the battle against itself. Where can we get information? Where do we look to first?
Yeah, I will tell you our website, sicklecelldisease.org, has information about sickle cell disease. We have people on staff that could answer your questions. If you don't live in the Maryland area, we have chapters, like I said, all around the country. So regardless of where your audience is, if they call us, we can direct them to an organization in their community if they're not in the state of Maryland. And we also have a Maryland chapter. We also have our annual convention next month, October 9th through the 12th, right here in Baltimore at the Renaissance Hotel, and people can still register to attend that. It is the largest gathering of patients, doctors, researchers, students, and nurses coming together to learn about sickle cell disease. And we have pharmaceutical companies coming to share what the latest clinical trials are and what is in drug development at the moment.
I want to go
they
back
can
to
also,
something there. I'm sorry. I do. I want to.
No, I was just
going to
give you our phone
quick.
Number as well.
Oh, okay, please.
Yes, our phone number is 410-528-1555. Or again, our website, sicklecelldisease.org. And we also have a Facebook page.
Okay.
Sickle
and I'm
going
to try to connect that and put that all on our Jeans Power Hour Facebook page as well. But
I wanted
to ask you about the doctors. The fact that you mentioned that people are ending up in the emergency rooms and the doctors don't know what to do, don't know how to handle these patients.
Yes.
How can we change that? What has happened? That can't happen anymore.
No. So we are part of an emergency room coalition, if you will, that is going around the country training physicians. We're also trying to get attention in medical schools, because in medical school, from what I understand, there may be a paragraph about sickle cell disease. And that does not tell you what to do when you see someone show up in the ER with sickle cell disease. And so we're really trying to get the Attorney General, the CDC, the NIH, and the big federal entities to help us raise the awareness that sickle cell disease curriculum needs to be included in medical school and nursing schools.
Okay. So let me, because I know we only got a few minutes left, what activities are going on this month that you're, I mean, I don't know if your organization is having any particular activities or if any of the chapters around the country are having any activities.
Yes. Actually, I was in Washington, D.C. all last week. I'm going back tomorrow for meetings. There was a large therapeutics conference discussing what the latest research mechanisms are for sickle cell disease. There are conferences and meetings all over the country I'm attending. I'm speaking actually at a sickle cell conference this coming Friday in New Jersey. I'll be in Portland, Oregon. So yeah, there's a lot happening around the country. I think on our website we actually post where a lot of the different events are, and we're asking our chapters to let us know what they're planning so that we can elevate what's happening nationally.
All right. So tell us, because like I said, we really need to know how to generate more awareness, and
yes,
we need to help those. Oh, one of the questions I was going to ask you, too, if you are taking care of yourself, if you are a sickle cell disease patient and you're taking care of yourself and you're getting the treatment that you're supposed to and everything, what is the, I guess you could say, life expectancy for a person with sickle cell disease?
I will tell you that most people are told that they're not going to live past their 30th birthday when you're first diagnosed with sickle cell disease. But I will tell you, if you do hydrate, you drink your water, you take care of your body, you know, proper rest and all of those things, we're now seeing patients that are living into their 70s. And I think we even have an 80-year-old woman living with sickle cell disease in Alabama. And so we are starting to see longevity for sickle cell patients in the country, but initially our patients were being told you're not going to live past 30.
Oh, wow. Okay. So what is the key point with the couple of minutes left that we have? What is the key point that you want to drive home for everybody that's listening?
I want to drive home to your listeners that sickle cell disease is not a death sentence and that it is not contagious. It is not anything that you have done to inherit this disease. It is a genetic blood disorder. And if you don't know what your status is, please ask your physician to be tested for the sickle cell trait. Our website is sicklecelldisease.org. Our phone number is 410-528-1555. Please email, call us to get more information about the disease or about where you can get help.
Okay. And in terms of, you were talking about funding earlier, is there a way that we can help in terms of generating the funds for the research and the treatment?
Yes, and so one of the things that we at Sickle Cell Disease Association of America does every year is we host an annual advocacy day that's 2 days in April when we actually all go to Washington, D.C. to meet with legislators to ask for support for sickle cell patients. And this is research and treatment for sickle cell patients around the country. And so if your viewers like us on Facebook or sign up on our website for more information, we will add them to our attendance list and they could join us in Washington in April of 2020. We had 18 states represented at the advocacy day that we did this year, and the representatives told us it was wonderful because we had patients sharing their stories with them, and so they could see that how this disease impacts and ravishes lives. We had people in wheelchairs that went to Washington because they wanted people to see them and understand what they're going through.
Well, when this comes up, please don't hesitate to reach back out to us here
okay.
at Power Hour so that we can make sure that we remind everybody and that we can draw more focus on this. And I have
Great.
To give a shameless plug out to my Knights of Peter Claver Ladies Auxiliary because that is one of our key charities that causes that we support is to try to help patients with sickle cell disease. So,
Thank you so much.
I would like to have everybody get on board with that.
Yes, please. We appreciate you.
We appreciate you. Thanks for taking the time out. You've given us a lot of knowledge, and like I said, don't hesitate to reach back out if something comes up before April. Please keep us posted.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a blessed day now.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And when we come back, you all, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be talking with Gal Sarid. He is going to talk a little bit about some comets, some asteroids, some other things that were going on. So we had a couple of them, I think, that came relatively, and, you know, you got to talk about miles and thousands of miles and so forth, close to Earth. So we're going to talk a little bit about that when we come back. This is G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. We'll be right back.
This is Douglas Dobbs, owner and funeral director at Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service. We have served the Central Florida community with two generations of family funeral service. With the recent addition of my son Brandon, we are here to take care of the needs of Central and West Orlando. From simple cremation to a full burial, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service is here to help you. Located at 430 North Kirkman Road at the 408 Expressway, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service, 407-578-7720. Dobbs, dedicated to serving our families.
Having a wedding, reception, family reunion, planning a banquet, or some other fundraising event. Need to share your knowledge through a workshop or seminar, or it's a difficult time and you need to plan a wake or repast. Let us help. At our gatherings, let us reduce the stress and make the occasion memorable, treasured. Call our gatherings at 407-968-9387 or email ourgatherings@yahoo.com. Let us help plan your special event.
Hi there. Good afternoon. Welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. Research scientist Gal Sarid is joining us today. How are you? Good afternoon.
I'm good, Gretchen. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Glad you were able to come back and speak with us, because there's been a few things that have been going on. So, and I know you have your finger on the pulse of all of that. So I wanted to start with asking you about launch of the Vikram lander. India was trying to be, the fourth nation in the world to do a robotic soft landing on the moon with the lander, but they've lost, some contact or whatever. Can you talk a little bit about what they had hoped to discover, with this launch to the moon, and how does this set, any type of research on the moon back right now?
Well, let's start with a quick qualifier. Despite maybe common opinion right now, landing on the moon is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very hard. And we've seen it earlier this year with the Israeli small spacecraft Bereshit that attempted to land on the moon, eventually crashed on the moon with a small small malfunction in its landing procedure. And it seems like the ISRO, the India Space Research Organization's project of the Chandrayaan 2 moon lander, has suffered something very similar. Now, they claim that it's probably a hard landing, but it didn't crash altogether. So their engineers are trying very hard to establish some sort of connection or communication with whatever piece of software or hardware that is intact on the moon. What is clear is that they're not going to be able to complete their lander mission. And in essence, to answer your other question, I don't think it really sets back our research, our scientific research and our technological understanding of operating around and on the moon. This is another attempt. From each of these failed attempts, we learn something new. From each of these failed attempts, we get another data point about how to better work on or improve our operations or improve our procedures to getting robotic landers, either rovers or just stationary landers, onto the moon.
Okay, well, that's good to know. So are there any other attempts coming up, between now and the end of the year that you can make us aware of, or any other type of exploration that's coming up that we need to kind of keep our eyes on?
Yeah, well, it turned out that the moon, although it doesn't have an atmosphere and it's pretty cold, is a very hot topic. So NASA has a big project called the Lunar Gateway, which actually started rolling about a year ago or so. And it is focused on the collaboration between public entities, mostly NASA, and private companies. So getting projects out, getting funding out for private companies that can build either parts of this concept of a lunar gateway and a constant presence in the lunar space to help us in both the scientific understanding of the moon and the technological advancement of operating on the moon and taking advantage of resources on the moon, and as a possible gateway to further points in the solar system, for example, the asteroid belt or Mars, etc. And so I don't think that by the end of this year, but in the next couple of years, we are definitely going to hear about several big attempts to get spacecrafts and parts of operations going on in between the Earth and the Moon. The most popular right now is the Artemis project, which is, you know, you can maybe look at it as the Apollo 2.0 big project that the U.S. has to build and operate a functional project that takes us from the Earth to the Moon and back, and establishing this kind of chain of hardware and software between the Earth and the Moon.
I also wanted to ask you about some occurrences that happened, I guess, over the weekend or late last week, about a couple of asteroids that flew by Earth. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, definitely. So, you know, we started pretty close to Earth on the moon, and we can go slightly bit further and see two asteroids that pass by the Earth. Now, I just would like to remind you and whoever's listening that when we say pass by the Earth, they're passing at about, I think it's 10 or 15 lunar distances from Earth, which is about 3 to 4 million miles away.
Okay.
So while we consider it as a close pass of the Earth, it is still far, very far from us and from kind of distances that we are used to thinking about on our day-to-day activities, right? I mean, how far do you go on your daily commute, for example?
Okay.
You know, I don't think you drive 3 million miles to work in that. It's still pretty far away. It's close enough that we consider the close pass by to the Earth, and it fits into this concept of potentially hazardous asteroids because they have the potential of coming very close to the Earth, so that any small perturbation in their future orbits might actually nudge them in a very kind of this pin-like orbit, this kind of keyhole orbit that would maybe put them in a collision trajectory with Earth.
I was going to ask you not that I want it to happen at all, but what would it take to make an asteroid or a comet or something veer off course where we have to worry about impact?
So something that can change a comet or an asteroid's orbit is its interaction with a larger, more massive body. For example, it could actually be the interaction with the Earth-Moon system that it passes by on its current orbit that would change its orbit just a little bit. So in subsequent orbits, it may get closer and closer to Earth. So its interactions between the Sun and the Earth-Moon and that small body might actually nudge that orbit either closer to Earth or further away. It's a bit of a chaotic kind of system there. But that's why we have to keep an eye on, we have to monitor the sky, we have to monitor the space around us to pick up these objects as small as we can pick them up at about 100 meter across and really pinpoint their orbits at a high level of accuracy.
Okay. So also, too, there was a discovery about a neutron star. Can you talk about that? Okay.
Yes, of course. Now we're moving very, very far away from Earth.
Okay.
So this is not close at all. This is very far away from Earth. So So astronomers detected what's called a neutron star. A neutron star, for lack of a better term, is a dead star. That's what happens to stars that are about they're slightly bigger than our sun, more massive than our sun, when they die. They die off in a violent event called supernova. They shed off their exterior layers, and their core is left there to keep contracting under its own gravity. Now, if it's there, it's a very, very massive star, it ends up that nothing can resist that gravity, and it becomes a black hole. However, if it's not that massive, not massive enough, then the gravity will push together the protons and the electrons and smush them together to create neutrons. And so all of the material in that core, in the heart of that star, eventually becomes a big ball of neutrons smushed together at a very, very high density. However, it is small. It is about 12 miles across or so. So about, you know, the distance between, I'd say, UCF campus and Winter Park, right? You can set a neutron star comfortably within that distance, and that's it. But it is extremely massive because it still has the mass of a two or three mass, a star that is about two or three times the mass of our sun. And now the new discovery is exciting because we don't exactly know what is the mass and size limit between a neutron star and a black hole. So there's a theoretical limit, but we need to test that theoretical limit to test our understanding of the basic physics and astrophysics. And so each discovery puts us at a better position to understand if we know the physics that we see around us. And it turns out that this is the most massive and largest neutron star that we've discovered, which scientists say that puts us right at that kind of limit, right at that tipping point. Anything a bit larger, a bit more massive than that, would probably have been a black hole. So this really kind of is a very basic piece of knowledge that puts all of our theoretical construct into context.
So now, I wanted to ask you about our big star here, the sun. What is from what can be told, just from what we know, what is the, I guess you could say, life expectancy before that particular star burns out?
Before a star like our sun?
Yes.
You mean yes? So our sun is, you know, fortunately for us, you can say, is a very typical run-of-the-mill, what's called a G-type star. A lot of the stars that we know are G-type stars. Stars that are G-type stars tend to live around roughly 10 billion years. And so if you look at the age of the Earth, and from that we derive what should be the sort of when did our solar system form and started evolving, that's right around 4.5 or 5 billion years. Which, again, if we do that very simple math, gives us a life expectancy of our sun of about another 4 to 5 billion years. So I wouldn't worry about my kids and my grandkids, but, you know, maybe their grandkids will have to worry. So what will happen to a star like our sun, a G-type star, is that it will end up puffing up, becoming what's called a red giant, to eventually, again, shed its external layers for them to expand and flow away from that center. And in the center, you will be left with most of the mass, most of the core of the sun, in the form of a white dwarf.
So there's so many other things that'll probably happen to our Earth by the time that we lose our sun, for sure.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, we can stray away from astrophysics or astronomy, you know, in 4 or 5 billion years. I truly believe humanity will have the chance to either, you know, break free of the chains of our own planet, or destroy itself several times over. There are different scenarios we can think of.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. We're going to take a quick break. We are here with Professor Gasa Reed of the University of Central Florida and Research Institute, Florida Space Institute. This is the Power Hour of Never Had It So Good Entertainment. If you have a question, the number is 516-387-1944, and we will be right back.
Hi, I'm Gretchen Dimp Simmons with Farrell Realty, but you know me as G from G's Power Hour. Much of the time when I'm not engaging with you on my show, I'm dealing in real estate in beautiful Central Florida. But because I'm here, that doesn't mean I can't help you wherever you are. So if you're looking to buy, invest, relocate, rent, or sell, please give me a call at 407-968-9387. That's 407-968-9387, and let me help you with your real estate needs.
Swiffer Sweeper cleans so completely, you'll never go back to your old broom again.
Now it's on for Mary from a Mr. Broom.
New Swiffer Sweeper is redesigned to clean corners, and it traps and locks 50% more dirt, dust, and hair than a broom. So go all the way clean. New Swiffer. Clean better or your money back. Guaranteed.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. Here with Professor Gasa Reed. He's a research scientist at the Florida Space Institute of the University of Central Florida. And so I think I briefly mentioned a comet, but you kind of are saying that we might get a comet coming into our solar system.
Oh yes, that's one of the things that I think that's the one thing that kept planetary astronomers on the edge of their seat in the last week or so. So we've had an interstellar visitor, an asteroid interstellar visitor last year, called Oumuamua, and there's been a lot of talk about it and a lot of press about it, and it's become a very popular thing. It turns out, again, serendipitously, we are not targeting to find these objects yet. But it turns out that there is a probable second interstellar visitor. Interstellar means that it's an object that has not originated in our solar system, but probably in a different solar system away from us.
Oh, wow.
It has been ejected. So it's been pushed out, kicked out by these gravitational interactions with the planets in that system, and has been roaming the galaxy for I don't know how long before it got very luckily, well, luckily for us, got caught by the gravity of our sun and started its dive, its orbit towards our sun. And we've detected this object. Actually, it's been detected by a Russian amateur astronomer called Borisov, very serendipitously. And people have picked up on these and have made more and more observations. And it seems like the more observations we make help us better refine the results of what is the orbit of this object. And it seems right now that this orbit is hyperbolic. It's coming from outside of our solar system. And it also seems that this object is fairly large. The visitor we had last year, the first asteroid, was about 100, 200 meters across. This object is probably around a kilometer or few across, so much bigger. But also it seems to be active, and active in the cometary sense. We look at images of this, and there's a little fuzzball around it, and we look at detections in the visible and near infrared, and there seems to be gaseous emissions coming off of that object. And so not only are we getting a visitor from outer space in our solar system, is it from extrasolar systems, but it's also an object that shows us what's happening inside of it. So it's very exciting, and it's all very new. Nothing is set in stone. It's just observations that keep coming in, and our understanding of this object keeps evolving.
So now, once it enters our solar system and everything, is it subject to stay within our solar system, or will it leave at some point?
No, it's a one-time visitor, Gretchen. We get it to come by close to our sun, and our sun nudges its orbit a bit, and it goes hyperbolic again, flying outside of our solar system at great speed. We will never see this object ever again.
Okay.
These are one-time visitors, that kind of knock on our door. They leave a bit of information about what's happening outside of our solar system, and they leave almost as quickly as they came in. So we really have a narrow window of opportunity to learn as much as we can about these kind of objects.
And so when is this expected to occur?
So the object is on its way in. So we've been tracking its orbit, and there are a few groups that in the last couple of days, maybe a week or so, have taken more careful measurements of various behaviors of this object, and so it actually has a designation now. It's called Comet C2019 Q4 Borisov. That's like the names we give comets. And right now you can actually go online and look for this. You can type in on Google C2019 Q4 Borisov, and you will probably get access to 99% of the information and data that the scientists have right now. It's just as new and exciting as it can be.
Okay, so now, if someone wanted to, where are places that if someone wanted to view something like this, where are places that people could go in Central Florida to view these?
Well, the first thing they would have to do is use a telescope.
Okay.
So, because right now this comet is expected to come at a closest approach to the sun of about 2 AU, so twice the distance between the Earth and the Sun, and it's probably going to be about 1 AU or more away from Earth. So at its closest distance to the Sun, it will be about 1 astronomical unit from us, so you would still need a telescope to see it. And it's going to be just as the year ends, around the end of December 2019.
Okay.
And so I'm assuming there'll be a lot of observational activities. I'm not entirely sure if there will be a lot of public viewing events for this object.
Okay. Just in general, if you have your telescope or whatever, or you want to do some stargazing, or you want to find, mm-hmm. let's say, I think most people know, if they want to know a little bit more about science, there's like the Orlando Science Center. But there are some other planetariums or places to study in the area, correct?
Correct. Seminole State College has a planetarium and an evening stargazing and astronomy activities from time to time. It's run through their Seminole State College Planetarium. UCS has monthly or once every 2 months activities called Nights Under the Stars. That's happening at the Robinson Observatory. It's on campus, and they have a website that's being updated regularly. So if you're interested, you can go online and look for the Robinson Observatory webpage at UCS, and you will get an update and clear table of information when these events are up. These events usually include some stargazing, some chat time with resident astronomers or resident astronomy amateur astronomers, and you'll get to see a lot of nice things in the sky. Again, weather permitting. We have to remember that this is Central Florida. We get overcast, we get rain, and there's nothing we can do about it. We don't have a magic wand, to wave around and move these things away. But in clear weather, we can definitely see craters on the moon, the rings of Saturn. If it's in our field of view, you can get an asteroid or a comet coming in. So it's a pretty neat way to spend your evening, a couple of hours during your evening. And it is Central Florida, so it's not very cold.
Right. That's the great thing about being here, because you can spend a little more time outdoors, and even when it's cold, it's more chilly than it is actually, freezing
Yeah. You can still spend some time at 9 p.m. watching the skies in your flip-flops and shorts.
Right, right, for sure. And I did find the schedule for the Nights Under the Stars, so I just put it on the G's Power Hour Facebook page, so that's good to know.
Great.
Yeah, so, you know, something a little bit different to do. I'm a movie geek usually, but this, I always look for something different to do, like an outdoor concert or something that I can do outdoors, so this will be really nice.
It's a nice activity, and from time to time there are also bigger activities like the International Observe the Moon Night, which usually has draws in a crowd of a couple of hundreds on UCF campus. It's usually done across from the big CFE arena.
Okay.
These are events that get more hype through Facebook and Twitter. So if you stay tuned to UCF announcements, you'll get updated.
Okay. All right. So what other things should we be following, through the end of the year?
So the regular things we can follow are what's happening, for example, with Bennu, the asteroid that is the target of the OSIRIS-REx mission. They have just recently announced that they've selected four potential areas where they can touch the surface, pick up a large swath of particles, of little stones from the surface, pack them, and send them back to Earth. These are four potential touchdown sites, and they need to decide which one. And this decision is tricky. You want to maximize the science. You want to optimize your technology return. You want to make sure that the mission works well. So I think probably by the end of the year, maybe another 6 months or so, they will be narrowing it down to one or two sites of selection, and these will be where we will get our next batch of material that's outside of Earth. And we've only had, material returned from the moon, a handful of materials from an asteroid brought down by the Japanese, a handful of material brought down from a comet by a mission called Stardust from Comet Field 2. This is going to be only, one of the handful of opportunities we get for these extraterrestrial materials to be studied closely in the lab. So that's going to be very exciting. And you should always keep your eye out for those serendipitous things, asteroids zipping by the Earth. Maybe another interstellar comet's going to give us a visit. The thing is, we never know. This is the beauty about, observing the sky, about looking at the heavens. A lot of what's happening is coming right at us, and we get little to no warning, and then it comes in. So it really is, jaw-dropping and awe-inspiring when we get these occurrences of nature without a lot of warning ahead of time.
Yeah, I was going to
As long as it's not smashing into us.
Definitely. I was going to ask, because that's one of the things I was going to ask you, for the average layperson, we're not necessarily researching and studying this, but for someone like you, how would you say not a lot of warning, if you're keeping your eye on it, how much warning do you get on some of this stuff?
So there are the regular comets and asteroids that we know and have established orbits, and we know how they behave. So these come in at a regular rate, and so we know when they're coming in. We have a good understanding of when they would get brighter and what are the better observing circumstances for them. Those serendipitous ones are the ones we don't know that show up. And so astronomers usually try and play that game between planning out observations of things that we know are active and we know are there and we know where to point our telescope and have very, very precise and deep observation of these objects, but having a bit of room left in these sky surveys to catch up objects that we don't know of. A good example of a very regular object is called 29P Schwassmann-Bachmann 1. It's a big, big comet that is circling the sun just outside of Jupiter's orbit, and it has been active. It has been continuously active for nearly 100 years. We have seen it active nearly 100 years. It has very large outbursts, about 5 to 7 times a year, and it's been so regular and dependable that some of us have started calling it cold faithful, as a play on old faithful. We know it's going to outburst. We know it's going to show us a great deal of coma and emission and really nice features, and we can almost set our watches to that behavior. That's kind of a regular object that we know where to point at the sky and what it will do.
Professor Sarid, thank you so much for taking the time out today. Really appreciate you catching us up. Have a blessed day.
Thank you, Gretchen. You too. Bye.
Bye. And thank you all for listening. This has been G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. Have a very blessed day, everyone, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care, and please remember, all real power comes from God.